eyes of the people only the commencement of the carnival. Suddenly the tumult ceased, as if by magic. The doors of the church opened. A brotherhood of penitents, clothed from head to foot in robes of grey sackcloth, with holes for the eyes alone, and holding in their hand a lighted taper, appeared first. The chief marched at the head. Behind the penitents came a man of vast stature and proportions. He was naked, with the exception of cloth drawers, at the left side of which hung a large knife in a sheath, and he bore on his right shoulder a heavy mace. This man was the executioner. He had, moreover, sandals bound on his feet by cords. Behind the executioner came, in the order in which they were to die, first Peppino and then Andrea. Each was accompanied by two priests. Neither had their eyes bandaged. Peppino walked with a firm step, doubtless aware of what awaited him. Andrea was supported by two priests. Each of them kissed from time to time the crucifix a confessor held out to them. At this sight alone, Franz felt his legs tremble under him. He looked at Albert. He was as white as his shirt, and mechanically cast away his cigar, although he had not half smoked it. The Count alone seemed unmoved. Nay, more, a slight colour seemed striving to rise in his pale cheeks. His nostril dilated like a wild beast that scents its prey, and his lips, half opened, disclosed his white teeth, small and sharp like those of a jackal. And yet his features wore an expression of smiling tenderness, such as Franz had never before witnessed in them. His black eyes especially were full of kindness and pity. However, the two culprits advanced, and as they approached, their faces became visible. Peppino was a handsome young man of 4 or 25, bronzed by the sun. He carried his head erect and seemed to look on which side his liberator would appear. Andrea was short and fat. His visage, marked with brutal cruelty, did not indicate age. He might be 30. In prison he had suffered his beard to grow. His head fell on his shoulder, his legs bent beneath him, and he seemed to obey a mechanical movement of which he was unconscious. "I thought," said Franz to the Count, "that you told me there would be but one execution."
"I told you true," replied he coldly.
"However, here are two culprits."
"Yes, but only one of these, too, is about to die. The other has long years to live. If the pardon is to come, there is no time to lose."
"And see, here it is," said the Count. At the moment when Peppino arrived at the foot of the Mandaia, a penitent who seemed to arrive late forced his way through the soldiers and, advancing to the chief of the Brotherhood, gave him a folded paper. The piercing eye of Peppino had noticed all. The chief took the paper, unfolded it, and raising his hands, "Heaven be praised, and His Holiness also," said he in a loud voice. "Here is a pardon for one of the prisoners."
"A pardon," cried the people with one voice. "A pardon."
At this cry, Andrea raised his head.
"Pardon for whom?" cried he.
Peppino remained breathless.
"A pardon for Peppino, called Rocca Priori," said the principal friar. And he passed the paper to the officer commanding the carbineers, who read and returned it to him.
"For Peppino!" cried Andrea, who seemed aroused from the torpor in which he had been plunged.
"Why for him, and not for me? We ought to die together. I was promised he should die with me. You have no right to put me to death alone. I will not die alone. I will not!"
And he broke from the priests, struggling and raving like a wild beast, and striving desperately to break the cords that bound his hands. The executioner made a sign, and his assistant leaped from the scaffold and seized him. A dreadful struggle ensued, Andrea exclaiming,
"He ought to die! He shall die! I will not die alone!"
The people all took part against Andrea, and 20,000 voices cried,
"Put him to death! Put him to death!"
Franz sprang back, but the Count seized his arm and held him before the window.
"What are you doing?" said he. "Do you pity him? If you heard the cry of mad dog, you would take your gun. You would unhesitatingly shoot the poor beast, who, after all, was only guilty of having been bitten by another dog. And yet you pity a man who, without being bitten by one of his race, has yet murdered his benefactor, and who, now unable to kill anyone because his hands are bound, wishes to see his companion in captivity perish. No, no. Look, look." This recommendation was needless. Franz was fascinated by the horrible spectacle. The two assistants had borne Andrea to the scaffold, and there, spite of his struggles, his bites and his cries, had forced him to his knees. During this time, the executioner had raised his mace and signed to them to get out of the way. The criminal strove to rise, but ere he had time, the mace fell on his left temple. A dull and heavy sound was heard, and the man dropped like an ox on his face, and then turned over on his back. The executioner let fall his mace, drew his knife, and with one stroke opened his throat, and, mounting on his stomach, stamped violently on it with his feet. At every stroke, a jet of blood sprang from the wound. This time Franz could sustain himself no longer, but sank half-fainting into a seat. Albert, with his eyes closed, was standing grasping the window curtains. The Count was erect and triumphant, like the avenging angel. 37. The Carnival at Rome. When Franz recovered his senses, he saw Albert drinking a glass of water, of which his paleness showed he stood in great need, and the Count, who was assuming his costume of paillasse. He glanced mechanically towards the Place. All had disappeared, scaffold, executioners, victims. Naught remained but the people full of noise and excitement. The bell of Monte Citorio, which only sounds on the Pope's decease and the opening of the carnival, was ringing a joyous peal. "Well," asked he of the Count, "what has then happened?" "Nothing," replied the Count, "only, as you see, the carnival has commenced. Make haste and dress yourself." "In reality," said Franz, "this horrible scene has passed away like a dream. It is but a dream, the nightmare that has disturbed you." "Yes, that I have suffered. But the culprit?" "That is a dream also. Only he has remained asleep whilst you have awoke. And who knows which of you is the most fortunate? But Peppino, what has become of him? Peppino is a lad of sense, who, unlike most men who are furious if they pass unnoticed, was delighted to see that the general attention was directed towards his companion. He profited by this distraction to slip away amongst the crowd, without even thanking the worthy priests who accompanied him. Decidedly, man is an ungrateful and egotistical animal. But dress yourself. See, Monsieur de Morcerf sets you the example." Albert was, in reality, drawing on the satin pantaloon over his black trousers and varnished boots. "Well, Albert," said Franz, "do you feel much inclined to join the revels? Come, answer frankly." "Ma foi, no," returned Albert. "But I am really glad to have seen such a sight. And I understand what Monsieur le Comte said, that when you have once habituated yourself to a similar spectacle, it is the only one that causes you any emotion." "Without reflecting that this is the only moment in which you can study characters," said the Count. "On the steps of the scaffold, death tears off the mask that has been worn through life, and the real visage is disclosed. It must be allowed Andrea was not very handsome, the hideous scoundrel. Come, dress yourselves, gentlemen, dress yourselves." Franz felt it would be ridiculous not to follow his two companions' example. He assumed his costume and fastened on his mask that scarcely equaled the pallor of his own face. Their toilette finished, they descended. The carriage awaited them at the door, filled with sweetmeats and bouquets. They fell into the line of carriages. It is difficult to form an idea of the perfect change that had taken place. Instead of the spectacle of gloomy and silent death, the Place del Popolo presented a spectacle of gay and noisy mirth and revelry. A crowd of masks flowed in from all sides, escaping from the doors, descending from the windows. From every street and every turn drove carriages filled with pierrots, harlequins, dominoes, marquises, Transnavarese knights and peasants, screaming, fighting, gesticulating, whirling eggs filled with flour, confetti, nosegays, attacking with their sarcasms and their missiles, friends and foes, companions and strangers, indiscriminately, without anyone taking offence or doing anything else than laugh. Franz and Albert were like men who, to drive away a violent sorrow, have recourse to wine, and who, as they drink and become intoxicated, feel a thick veil drawn between the past and the present. They saw, or rather continued to see, the image of what they had witnessed, but little by little the general vertigo seized them, and they felt themselves obliged to take a part in the noise and confusion. A handful of confetti that came from a neighbouring carriage, and which, whilst it covered Morcerf and his two companions with dust, pricked his neck and that portion of his face uncovered by his mask like 100 pins, plunged him into the general combat in which all the masks around him were engaged. He rose in his turn, and seizing handfuls of confetti and sweetmeats with which the carriage was filled, cast them with all the force and address he was master of. The strife had fairly commenced, and the recollection of what they had seen half an hour before was gradually effaced from the young men's minds, so much were they occupied by the gay and glittering procession they now beheld. As for the Count of Monte Cristo, he had never for an instant showed any appearance of having been moved. Imagine the large and splendid Rue de Cour, bordered from one end to the other with lofty palaces, with their balconies hung with carpets, and their windows with flags. At these balconies 300,000 spectators, Romans, Italians, strangers from all parts of the world. The united aristocracy of birth, wealth, and genius, lovely women who, yielding to the influence of the scene, bend over their balconies or lean from their windows and shower down confetti which are returned by bouquets. The air seems darkened with confetti that fall and flowers that mount. In the streets, the lively crowd, dressed in the most fantastic costumes, gigantic cabbages walked gravely about, buffaloes' heads bellowed from men's shoulders, dogs who walked on their hind legs. In the midst of all this, a mask is lifted, and, as in Caillaux's Temptation of St. Anthony, a lovely face is exhibited, which we would fain follow, but from which we are separated by troops of fiends, and this will give a faint idea of the carnival at Rome. At the second turn, the Count stopped the carriage and requested permission to quit them, leaving the vehicle at their disposal. Franz looked up. They were opposite the Rospoli Palace. At the centre window, the one hung with white damask with a red cross, was a blue domino, beneath which Franz's imagination easily pictured the beautiful Greek of the Argentina. "Gentlemen," said the Count, springing out, "when you are tired of being actors and wish to become spectators of this scene, you know you have places at my windows. In the meantime, dispose of my coachman, my carriage, and my servants." We have forgotten to mention that the Count's coachman was attired in a bearskin, exactly resembling Audrey's in The Bear and the Pasha, and the two footmen behind were dressed up as green monkeys with spring masks, with which they made grimaces at everyone who passed. Franz thanked the Count for his attention. As for Albert, he was busily occupied throwing bouquets at a carriage full of Roman peasants that was passing near him. Unfortunately for him, the line of carriages moved on again, and whilst he descended the Place del Popolo, the other ascended towards the Palais de Venise. "Ah, my dear fellow," said he to Franz, "you did not see. What? There, that calèche filled with Roman peasants. No. Well, I am convinced they were all charming women." "How unfortunate you were masked, Albert," said Franz. "Here was an opportunity of making up for past disappointments." "Oh," replied he, half laughing, half serious, "I hope the carnival will not pass without some amends in one shape or another." But in spite of Albert's hope, the day passed unmarked by any incident, except meeting two or three times the calèche with the Roman peasants. At one of these encounters, accidentally or purposely, Albert's mask fell off. He instantly rose and cast the remainder of the bouquets into the carriage. Doubtless one of the charming females Albert had divined beneath their coquettish disguise was touched by his gallantry, for in her turn, as the carriage of the two friends passed her, she threw a bunch of violets into it. Albert seized it, and as Franz had no reason to suppose it was addressed to him, he suffered Albert to retain it. Albert placed it in his buttonhole, and the carriage went triumphantly on. "Well," said Franz to him, "here is the commencement of an adventure. Laugh if you please. I really think so. So I will not abandon this bouquet." "Pardieu," returned Franz, laughing, "in token of your gratitude." The jest, however, soon appeared to become earnest, for when Albert and Franz again encountered the carriage with the contadini, the one who had thrown the violets to Albert clapped her hands when she beheld them in his buttonhole. "Bravo! Bravo!" said Franz. "Things go wonderfully. Shall I leave you? Perhaps you would prefer being alone." "No," replied he. "I will not be caught like a fool at a first demonstration by a rendezvous beneath the clock, as they say at the opera balls. If the fair peasant wishes to carry matters any further, we shall find her, or rather she will find us, tomorrow. Then she will give me some sign or other, and I shall know what I have to do." "On my word," said Franz, "you are wise as Nestor and prudent as Ulysses, and your fair Circe must be very skilful or very powerful if she succeed in changing you into a beast of any kind." Albert was right. The fair unknown had resolved, doubtless, to carry the intrigue no further. For although the young men made several more turns, they did not again see the caleche, which had turned up one of the neighbouring streets. Then they returned to the Rospoli Palace, but the Count and the Blue Domino had also disappeared. The two windows, hung with yellow damask, were still occupied by the persons whom the Count had invited. At this moment, the same bell that had proclaimed the commencement of the mascherata sounded the retreat. The file on the Corso broke the line, and in a second all the carriages had disappeared. Franz and Albert were opposite the Via della Marate. The coachman, without saying a word, drove up it, passed along the Place d'Espagne and the Rospoli Palace, and stopped at the door of the hotel. Maitre Pastrini came to the door to receive his guests. Franz's first care was to inquire after the Count, and to express his regret he had not returned in sufficient time to take him up. But Pastrini reassured him by saying that the Count of Monte Cristo had ordered a second carriage for himself, and that it had gone at 4 o'clock to fetch him from the Rospoli Palace. The Count had, moreover, charged him to offer the two friends the key of his box at the Argentina. Franz questioned Albert as to his intentions, but Albert had great projects to put into execution before going to the theatre, and instead of making any answer, he inquired if Maitre Pastrini could procure him a tailor. "A tailor?" said the host. "And for what?" "To make us, between now and tomorrow, 2 costumes of Roman peasants," returned Albert. The host shook his head. "To make you 2 costumes between now and tomorrow? I ask your excellency's pardon, but this is a demand quite French. For the next week you will not find a single tailor who would consent to sew 6 buttons on a waistcoat if you paid him 1 crown apiece for each button."
"Then I must give up the idea?"
"No. We have them ready made. Leave all to me, and tomorrow, when you wake, you shall find a collection of costumes with which you will be satisfied."
"My dear Albert," said Franz, "leave all to our host. He has already proved himself full of resources. Let us dine quietly, and afterwards go and see l'Italien à Alger."
"Agreed," returned Albert. "But recollect, Maitre Pastrini, that both my friend and myself attach the greatest importance to having tomorrow the costumes we have asked for." The host again assured them they might rely on him, and that their wishes should be attended to, upon which Franz and Albert mounted to their apartments and proceeded to disencumber themselves of their costume. Albert, as he took off his dress, carefully preserved the bunch of violets. It was his sign of recognition for the morrow. The two friends sat down to table, but they could not refrain from remarking the difference between the table of the Count of Monte Cristo and that of Maitre Pastrini. Truth compelled Franz, spite of the dislike he seemed to have taken to the Count, to confess that the advantage was not on Pastrini's side. During dessert, the servant inquired at what time they wished for the carriage. Albert and Franz looked at each other, fearing really to abuse the Count's kindness. The servant understood them. "His Excellency the Count of Monte Cristo had," he said, "given positive orders that the carriage was to remain at their lordship's orders all the day, and they could, therefore, dispose of it without fear of indiscretion." They resolved to profit by the Count's courtesy, and ordered the horses to be harnessed, whilst they substituted an evening costume for that which they had on, and which was somewhat the worse for the numerous combats they had sustained.
This precaution taken, they went to the theatre and installed themselves in the Count's box. During the first act, the Countess G entered hers. Her first look was at the loge where she had seen the Count the previous evening, so that she perceived Franz and Albert in the box of the very person concerning whom she had expressed so strange an opinion to Franz. Her opera glass was so fixedly directed towards them that Franz saw it would be cruel not to satisfy her curiosity, and availing himself on one of the privileges of the spectators of the Italian theatres, which consists in using their boxes as their drawing room, the two friends quitted their box to pay their respects to the Countess. Scarcely had they entered the loge than she motioned to Franz to assume the seat of honour. Albert, in his turn, sat behind.
"Well," said she, hardly giving Franz time to sit down, "it seems you have nothing better to do than to make the acquaintance of this new Lord Ruthven, and you are the best friends in the world."
"Without being so far advanced as that, Madame la Comtesse," returned Franz, "I cannot deny we have abused his good nature all day."
"All day?"
"Yes. This morning we breakfasted with him. We rode in his carriage all day, and now we have taken possession of his box."
"You know him, then?"
"Yes and no."
"How so?"
"It is a long story. Relate it to me. It would frighten you too much."
"Another reason."
"At least, wait until the story has a conclusion."
"Very well. I prefer complete histories. But tell me how you made his acquaintance. Did anyone introduce you to him?"
"No. It was he who introduced himself to us."
"When?"
"Last night, after we left you."
"Through what medium?"
"The very prosaic one of our landlord."
"He is staying, then, at the Hôtel de Londres with you?"
"Not only in the same hotel, but on the same floor."
"What is his name? For, of course, you know."
"The Count of Monte Cristo."
"That is not a family name."
"No, it is the name of the isle he has purchased."
"And he is a count, a Tuscan count?"
"Well, we must put up with that," said the Countess, who was herself of one of the oldest families of Venice.
"What sort of a man is he?"
asked the Vicomte de Morcerf.
"You hear, Monsieur de Morcerf, I am referred to you," said the Countess.
"We should be very hard to please, madame," returned Albert, "did we not think him delightful. A friend of 10 years' standing could not have done more for us, or with a more perfect courtesy."
"Come," observed the Countess, smiling, "I see my vampire is only some millionaire who has taken the appearance of Lara in order to avoid being confounded with Monsieur de Rothschild. And have you seen her?"
"Her?
The beautiful Greek of yesterday?"
"No. We heard, I think, the sound of her guzla, but she remained perfectly invisible."
"When you say invisible," interrupted Albert, "it is only to keep up the mystery. For whom do you take the blue domino at the window with the white curtains?"
"Where was this window with white hangings?" said the Countess.
"At the Rospoli Palace."
"The Count had 3 windows of the Rospoli Palace?"
"Yes.
Did you pass through the Rue de Cour?"
"Yes."
"Well, did you remark 2 windows hung with yellow damask and 1 with white damask with a red cross? Those were the Count's windows."
"Why, he must be a nabob. Do you know what those 3 windows were worth?"
200 or 300 Roman crowns?"
2 or 3,000?
"The devil!
Does his isle produce him such a revenue?"
"It does not bring him a bajocco."
"Then why did he purchase it?"
"For a whim."
"He is an original, then?"
"In reality," observed Albert, "he seemed to me somewhat eccentric. Were he at Paris, and a frequenter of the theatres, I should say he was a poor devil literally mad. This morning he made 2 or 3 exits worthy of Didier or Antony." At this moment a fresh visitor entered, and, according to custom, Franz gave up his seat to him. This circumstance had, moreover, the effect of changing the conversation. An hour afterwards the two friends returned to their hotel. Maitre Pastrini had already set about procuring their disguises for the morrow, and he assured them they would be perfectly satisfied. The next morning at 9 o'clock, he entered Franz's room, followed by a tailor who had 8 or 10 costumes of Roman peasants on his arm. They selected 2 exactly alike, and charged the tailor to sew on each of their hats about 20 yards of riband, and to procure them 2 of those long silken sashes of different colours with which the lower orders decorate themselves on fete days. Albert was impatient to see how he looked in his new dress. It was a jacket and breeches of blue velvet, silk stockings with clocks, shoes with buckles, and a silk waistcoat. This picturesque attire set him off to great advantage, and when he had bound the scarf around his waist, and when his hat, placed coquettishly on one side, let fall on his shoulder a stream of ribbons, Franz was forced to confess that costume has much to do with the physical superiority we accord to certain nations. Franz complimented Albert, who looked at himself in the glass with an unequivocal smile of satisfaction. They were thus engaged when the Count of Monte Cristo entered. "Gentlemen," said he, "although a companion is agreeable, perfect freedom is sometimes still more agreeable. I come to say that today and the remainder of the carnival I leave the carriage entirely at your disposal. The host will tell you I have 3 or 4 more, so that you do not deprive me in any way of it. Employ it, I pray you, for your pleasure or your business." The young men wished to decline, but they could find no good reason for refusing an offer which was so agreeable to them. The Count of Monte Cristo remained 1/4 hour with them, conversing on all subjects with the greatest ease. He was, as we have already said, perfectly well acquainted with the literature of all countries. A glance at the walls of his salon proved to Franz and Albert that he was no amateur of pictures. A few words he let fall showed them he was no stranger to the sciences, and he seemed much occupied with chemistry. The 2 friends did not venture to return the Count the breakfast he had given them. It would have been too absurd to offer him, in exchange for his excellent table, the very inferior one of Maitre Pastrini. They told him so frankly, and he received their excuses with the air of a man who appreciated their delicacy. Albert was charmed with the Count's manners, and he was only prevented from recognizing him for a veritable gentleman by his science. The permission to do what he liked with the carriage pleased him above all, for the fair peasants had appeared in a most elegant carriage the preceding evening, and Albert was not sorry to be upon an equal footing with them. At 1:30 they descended. The coachman and footman had put on their livery over their disguises, which gave them a more ridiculous appearance than ever, and which gained them the applause of Franz and Albert. Albert had fastened the faded bunch of violets to his buttonhole. At the first sound of the bell, they hastened into the Rue de Cour by the Via Vittoria. At the second turn, a bunch of fresh violets, thrown from a carriage filled with paillassines, indicated to Albert that, like himself and his friend, the peasants had changed their costume also, and whether it was the result of chance or whether a similar feeling had possessed them both, whilst he had changed his costume, they had assumed his. Albert placed the fresh bouquet in his buttonhole, but he kept the faded one in his hand, and when he again met the caleche, he raised it to his lips, an action which seemed greatly to amuse not only the fair lady who had thrown it, but her joyous companions also. The day was as gay as the preceding one, perhaps even more animated and noisy. The Count appeared for an instant at his window, but when they again repassed, he had disappeared. It is almost needless to say that the flirtation between Albert and the fair peasant continued all day. The evening on his return, Franz found a letter from the embassy to inform him he would have the honour of being received by His Holiness the next day. At each previous visit he had made to Rome, he had solicited and obtained the same favour, and, incited as much by a religious feeling as by gratitude, he was unwilling to quit the capital of the Christian world without laying his respectful homage at the feet of one of St. Peter's successors, who has set the rare example of all virtues. He did not then think of the carnival, for in spite of his condescension and touching kindness, one cannot incline oneself without awe before the venerable and noble old man called Gregory the 16th. On his return from the Vatican, Franz carefully avoided the Rue de Cor. He brought away with him a treasure of pious thoughts to which the mad gaiety of the Mascherata would have been profanation. At 5:10, Albert entered overjoyed. The Piacine had resumed her peasant's costume, and as she passed had raised her mask. She was charming. Franz congratulated Albert, who received his congratulations with the air of a man conscious they are merited. He had recognized by certain unmistakable signs that his fair incognita belonged to the aristocracy. He had made up his mind to write to her the next day. Franz remarked, whilst he gave these details, that Albert seemed to have something to ask of him, but that he was unwilling to ask it. He insisted upon it, declaring beforehand that he was willing to make any sacrifice he required. Albert let himself be pressed just as long as friendship required, and then avowed to Franz that he would do him a great favour by suffering him to occupy the carriage alone the next day. Albert attributed to Franz's absence the extreme kindness of the fair peasant in raising her mask. Franz was not sufficiently egotistical to stop Albert in the middle of an adventure that promised to prove so agreeable to his curiosity and so flattering to his vanity. He felt assured that the perfect indiscretion of his friend would duly inform him of all that happened, and as, during 3 years that he had travelled all over Italy, a similar piece of good fortune had never fallen to his share, Franz was by no means sorry to learn how to act on such an occasion. He therefore promised Albert that he would content himself the morrow with witnessing the carnival from the windows of Rospoli Palace. The next morning he saw Albert pass and repass. He held an enormous bouquet, which he doubtless meant to make the bearer of his amorous epistle. This belief was changed into certainty when Franz saw the bouquet, remarkable by a circle of white camellias, in the hand of a charming Piacine dressed in rose-coloured satin. The evening was no longer joy, but delirium. Albert nothing doubted but that the fair unknown would reply in the same manner. Franz anticipated his wishes by telling him the noise fatigued him, and that he should pass the next day in writing and looking over his journal. Albert was not deceived, for the next evening Franz saw him enter, shaking triumphantly a folded paper he held by one corner. "Well," said he, "was I mistaken?" "She has answered you?" cried Franz. "Read." This word was pronounced in a manner impossible to describe. Franz took the letter and read, "Tuesday evening at 7:00, descend from your carriage opposite the Via dei Pontefici and follow the Roman peasant who snatches your moccoletto from you. When you arrive at the first step of the church of San Giacomo, be sure to fasten a knot of rose-coloured ribbons to the shoulder of your costume of paillasse in order that you may be recognized. Until then, you will not see me. Constancy and discretion." "Well," asked he when Franz had finished, "what do you think of that?" "I think that the adventure is assuming a very agreeable appearance." "I think so also," replied Albert, "and I very much fear you will go alone to the Duke of Bracciano's ball." Franz and Albert had received that morning an invitation from the celebrated Roman banker. "Take care, Albert," said Franz. "All the nobility of Rome will be present, and if your fair incognita belongs to the higher class of society, she must go there." "Laugh as much as you will," replied Albert. "I am in love." "You alarm me," cried Franz. "I see that I shall not only go alone to the Duke of Bracciano's, but also return to Florence alone. If my unknown be as amiable as she is beautiful," said Albert, "I shall fix myself at Rome for 6 weeks at least. I adore Rome, and I have always had a great taste for archaeology. Come, 2 or 3 more such adventures, and I do not despair of seeing you a member of the Academy." Doubtless, Albert was about to discuss seriously his right to the academic chair when they were informed dinner was ready. Albert's love had not taken away his appetite. He hastened with Franz to seat himself, free to recommence the discussion after dinner. After dinner, the Count of Monte Cristo was announced. They had not seen him for 2 days. Maitre Pastrini informed them that business had called him to Civita Vecchia. He had started the previous evening and had only returned an hour since. He was charming. Whether he kept a watch over himself, or whether accident did not sound the acrimonious chords that certain circumstances had already touched, he was like everybody else. This man was an enigma to France. The Count must feel sure he recognized him, and yet he had not let fall a single word that indicated he had seen him anywhere. On his side, however great France's desire was to allude to their former interview, the fear of its being disagreeable to the man who had loaded himself and his friend with kindness prevented him from mentioning it. The Count had learned the two friends had sent to secure a box at the Argentina Theatre and were told they were all let. In consequence, he brought them the key of his own, at least such was the apparent motive of his visit. Franz and Albert made some difficulty, alleging their fear of depriving him of it, but the Count replied that as he was going to the Pali Theatre, the box at the Argentina Theatre would be lost if they did not profit by it. This assurance determined the two friends to accept it. Franz had become by degrees accustomed to the Count's paleness, which had so forcibly struck him the first time he saw him. He could not refrain from admiring the severe beauty of his features, the only defect, or rather the principal quality of which was the pallor. Veritable hero of Byron. The Count was no longer young. He was at least 40, and yet it was easy to understand he was formed to rule the young men with whom he associated at present. In reality, to complete his resemblance with the fantastic heroes of the English poet, the Count seemed to have the power of fascination. Albert was constantly expatiating on their good fortune in meeting such a man. Franz was less enthusiastic, but the Count exercised over him also the ascendancy a strong mind always acquires. He thought several times of the project the Count had of visiting Paris, and he had no doubt but that with his eccentric character, his characteristic face, and his colossal fortune, he would produce a great effect there. And yet he did not wish to be at Paris when the Count was there. The evening passed as evenings mostly pass at Italian theatres, that is, not in listening to the music, but in paying visits and conversing. The Countess G. wished to revive the subject of the Count, but Franz announced he had something far newer to tell her, and in spite of Albert's demonstrations of false modesty, he informed the Countess of the great event which had preoccupied them for the last 3 days. As similar intrigues are not uncommon in Italy, if we may credit travellers, the Countess did not manifest the least incredulity, but congratulated Albert on his success. They promised, upon separating, to meet at the Duke of Bracciano's ball, to which all Rome was invited. The heroine of the bouquet kept her word. She gave Albert no sign of her existence the morrow and day after. At length arrived the Tuesday, the last and most tumultuous day of the carnival. The Tuesday the theatres open at 10 o'clock in the morning, as Lent begins after 8 at night. The Tuesday all those who, through want of money, time, or enthusiasm, have not been to see the carnival before, mingle in the gaiety and contribute to the noise of excitement. From 2 o'clock till 5, Franz and Albert followed in the fête, exchanging handfuls of confetti with the other carriages and the pedestrians, who crowded amongst the horses' feet and the carriage wheels without a single accident, a single dispute, or a single fight. Albert was triumphant in his costume of paillasse. A knot of rose-coloured ribbons fell from his shoulder almost to the ground. In order that there might be no confusion, Franz wore his peasant's costume. As the day advanced, the tumult became greater. There was not on the pavement, in the carriages, at the windows, a single tongue that was silent, a single arm that did not move. It was a human storm, composed of a thunder of cries and a hail of sweetmeats, flowers, eggs, oranges, and nosegays. At 3 o'clock, the sound of fireworks let off on the Place del Popolo and the Palais de Venise, heard with difficulty amid the din and confusion, announced that the races were about to begin. The races, like the Moccoli, are one of the episodes peculiar to the last days of the carnival.
At the sound of the fireworks, the carriages instantly broke the ranks and retired by the adjacent streets. All these evolutions are executed with an inconceivable address and marvellous rapidity, without the police interfering in the matter. The pedestrians ranged themselves against the walls. Then the trampling of horses and the clashing of steel were heard. A detachment of carbineers, 15 abreast, galloped up the Rue du Cours in order to clear it for the barbari. When the detachment arrived at the Palais de Venise, a second volley of fireworks was again discharged to announce that the street was clear. Almost instantly, in the midst of a tremendous and general outcry, 7 or 8 horses, excited by the shouts of 300,000 spectators, passed by like lightning. Then the castle of Sant'Angelo fired 3 cannons to indicate that number 3 had won. Immediately, without any other signal, the carriages moved on, flowing on towards the Corso, down all the streets, like torrents pent up for a while, which again flow into the parent river, and the immense stream again continued its course between its 2 banks of granite. A new source of noise and movement was added to the crowd. The sellers of Moccoletti entered on the scene. The moccoli, or moccoletti, are candles which vary in size from the paschal taper to the rushlight, and which cause the actors on the great scene which terminates the carnival 2 different sources of thought. First, how to preserve their moccoletti alight. Second, how to extinguish the moccoletti of others. The moccoletti is like life. Man has found but 1 means of transmitting it, and that one comes from God. But he has discovered 1,000 means of taking it away, although the devil has somewhat aided him. The moccoletti is kindled by approaching it to a light. But who can describe the 1,000 means of extinguishing the moccoletti? The gigantic bellows, the monstrous extinguishers, the superhuman fans. Everyone hastened to purchase moccoletti, Franz and Albert among the rest. The night was rapidly approaching, and already at the cry of "Moccoletti!" repeated by the shrill voices of 1,000 vendors, 2 or 3 stars began to burn among the crowd. It was a signal. At the end of 10 minutes, 50,000 lights glittered, descending from the Palais de Venise to the Place del Popolo, and mounting from the Place del Popolo to the Palais de Venise. It seemed the fête of jack-o'-lanterns. It is impossible to form any idea of it without having seen it. Suppose all the stars had descended from the sky and mingled in a wild dance on the face of the earth, the whole accompanied by cries that were never heard in any other part of the world. The facchino follows the prince, the Transtevere the citizen, everyone blowing, extinguishing, relighting. Had old Aeolus appeared at this moment, he would have been proclaimed king of the moccoli, and Achilo the heir presumptive to the throne. This flaming race continued for 2 hours. The Rue du Cours was light as day. The features of the spectators on the 3rd and 4th stories were visible. Every 5 minutes Albert took out his watch. At length it pointed to 7. The 2 friends were in the Via dei Pontefici. Albert sprang out, bearing his moccoletto in his hand. 2 or 3 masks strove to knock his moccoletto out of his hand, but Albert, a first-rate pugilist, sent them rolling in the street one after the other and continued his course towards the Church of San Giacomo. The steps were crowded with masks, who strove to snatch each other's flambeau. Franz followed Albert with his eyes and saw him mount the first step. Instantly a mask, wearing the well-known costume of a female peasant, snatched his moccoletto from him without his offering any resistance. Franz was too far off to hear what they said, but without doubt nothing hostile passed, for he saw Albert disappear arm in arm with the peasant girl. He watched them pass through the crowd some time, but at length he lost sight of them in the Via Macello. Suddenly the bell that gives the signal for the carnival sounded, and at the same instant all the moccoletti were extinguished as if by enchantment. It seemed as though 1 immense blast of the wind had extinguished every one. Franz found himself in utter darkness. No sound was audible save that of the carriages that conveyed the masks home. Nothing was visible save a few lights that burnt behind the windows. The carnival was finished. 38. The Catacombs of San Sebastian. Dinner was waiting when Franz, after a 10 minutes' drive, arrived at the Hôtel de Londres. Albert had told him that he should not return so soon, and Franz sat down without him. Maitre Pastrini, who had been accustomed to see them dine together, inquired into the cause of his absence, but Franz merely replied that Albert had received on the previous evening an invitation which he had accepted. Franz resolved to wait for Albert as late as possible. He ordered the carriage, therefore, for 11 o'clock, desiring Maitre Pastrini to inform him the moment Albert returned to the hotel. At 11 o'clock, Albert had not come back. Franz dressed himself and went out, telling his host that he was going to pass the night at the Duke of Bracciano's. The house of the Duke of Bracciano is one of the most delightful in Rome. His lady, one of the last heiresses of the Colonnas, does its honours with the most consummate grace, and thus their fêtes have a European celebrity. Franz and Albert had brought to Rome letters of introduction to them, and the Count's first question on Franz's arrival was to ask him where was his travelling companion. Franz replied that he had left him at the moment they were about to extinguish the Moccoli, and that he had lost sight of him in the Via Macello. "Then he has not returned?" said the Duke. "I waited for him until this hour," replied Franz. "And do you know whither he went?" "No, not precisely. However, I think it was something very like an assignation." "Diavolo," said the Duke. "This is a bad day, or rather a bad night, to be out late. Is it not, Countess?" These words were addressed to the Countess G, who had just arrived, and was leaning on the arm of Signor Tolonia, the Duke's brother.
"I think, on the contrary, that it is a charming night," replied the Countess, "and those who are here will not complain but of one thing, that of its too rapid flight."
"I am not speaking," said the Duke with a smile, "of the persons who are here. The men run no other danger than that of falling in love with you, and the women of falling ill of jealousy at seeing you so lovely. I alluded to persons who were out in the streets of Rome."
"Ah?" asked the Countess. "Who is out in the streets of Rome at this hour, unless it be to go to a ball?"
"Our friend Albert de Morcerf, Countess, whom I left in pursuit of his unknown about 7 o'clock this evening," said Franz, "and whom I have not since seen."
"And don't you know where he is?"
"Not at all."
"Is he armed?"
"He is en paillasse." "You should not have allowed him to go," said the Duke to Franz. "You who know Rome better than he does. You might as well have tried to stop number 3 of the Barberi, who gained the prize in the race today," replied Franz. "And then, moreover, what could happen to him?"
"Who can tell? The night is gloomy, and the Tiber is very near the Via Macello."
Franz felt a shudder run through his veins at observing the feeling of the Duke and the Countess so much in unison with his own personal disquietude.
"I informed them at the hotel that I had the honour of passing the night here, Duke," said Franz, "and desired them to come and inform me of his return."
"Ah," replied the Duke, "here, I think, is one of my servants who is seeking you." The Duke was not mistaken. When he saw Franz, the servant came up to him.
"Your Excellency," he said, "the master of the Hotel de Londres has sent to let you know that a man is waiting for you with a letter from the Vicomte de Morcerf."
"A letter from the Viscount?" exclaimed Franz. "And where is the messenger?"
"He went away directly he saw me enter the ballroom to find you."
"Oh," said the Countess to Franz, "go with all speed. Poor young man, perhaps some accident has happened to him."
"I will hasten," replied Franz.
"Shall we see you again to give us any information?" inquired the Countess.
"Yes, if it is not any serious affair. Otherwise I cannot answer as to what I may do myself."
Franz took his hat and went away in haste. He had sent away his carriage with orders for it to fetch him at 2 o'clock. Fortunately, the Palazzo Bracciano, which is on one side in the Rue du Cor and on the other in the Place de Saint-Apôtre, is hardly 10 minutes' walk from the Hôtel de Londres. As he came near the hotel, Franz saw a man in the centre of the street. He had no doubt that it was the messenger from Albert. The man was wrapped up in a large cloak. He went up to him, but to his extreme astonishment, this individual first addressed him.
"What wants your Excellency of me?" inquired the man, retreating a step or two as if to keep on his guard.
"Are not you the person who brought me a letter," inquired Franz, "from the Vicomte de Morcerf?"
"Your Excellency's name is the Baron Franz d'Epernay.
Then it is to your Excellency that this letter is addressed."
Is there any answer? Inquired France, taking the letter from him.
Yes, your friend at least hopes so. Come upstairs with me and I will give it to you. I prefer waiting here, said the messenger with a smile.
And why? Your Excellency will know when you have read the letter. Shall I find you then here?
Certainly.
France entered the hotel. On the staircase he met Maitre Pastrini.
Well, said the landlord.
Well, what? Responded France.
You have seen the man who desired to speak with you from your friend? He asked of France.
Yes, I have seen him, he replied, and he has handed this letter to me. Light the candle in my apartment, if you please. The innkeeper gave orders to a servant to go before France with a bougie. The young man had found Maitre Pastrini looking very much alarmed, and this had only made him the more anxious to read Albert's letter, and thus he went instantly towards the waxlight and unfolded the letter. It was written and signed by Albert. Franz read it twice before he could comprehend what it contained. It was thus worded. My dear fellow, the moment you have received this, have the kindness to take from my pocket-book, which you will find in the square drawer of the secretaire, the letter of credit. Add your own to it, if it be not sufficient. Run to Tolonia, draw from him instantly 4,000 piastres, and give them to the bearer. It is urgent that I should have this money without delay. I do not say more, relying on you as you may rely on me, your friend Albert de Morcerf. P.S. I now believe in Italian banditti. Below these lines were written, in a strange hand, the following in Italian.
Si alle sei della mattina le 4,000 piastre non sono nelle mie mani, alle 7 il conte Alberto avrà cessato di vivere. Luigi Vampa.
If by 6 in the morning the 4,000 piastres are not in my hands, by 7 o'clock the Count Albert will have ceased to live. This second signature explained all to France, who now understood the objection of the messenger to coming up into the apartment. The street was safer for him. Albert, then, had fallen into the hands of the famous chief of banditti, in whose existence he had for so long a time refused to believe. There was no time to lose. He hastened to open the secretaire and found the pocketbook in the drawer, and in it the letter of credit. There was in all 6,000 piastres, but of these 6,000, Albert had already expended 3,000. As to France, he had no letter of credit as he lived at Florence, and had only come to Rome to pass 7 or 8 days. He had brought but 100 louis, and of these he had not more than 50 left. Thus, 700 or 800 piastres were wanting to them both to make up the sum that Albert required. True, he might in such a case rely on the kindness of Monsieur Tolonia. He was, therefore, about to return to the Palazzo Bracciano without loss of time when suddenly a luminous idea crossed his mind. He remembered the Count of Monte Cristo. Franz was about to ring for Maitre Pastrini when that worthy presented himself. "My dear sir," he said hastily, "do you know if the Count is within?"
"Yes, Your Excellency, he has this moment returned. Then ring at his door, if you please, and request him to be so kind as to give me an audience."
Maitre Pastrini did as he was desired, and returning 5 minutes after, he said, "The Count awaits, Your Excellency." Franz went along the corridor, and a servant introduced him to the Count. He was in a small cabinet which Franz had not yet seen, and which was surrounded with divans. The Count came towards him.
"Well, what good wind blows you hither at this hour?" said he. "Have you come to sup with me? It would be very kind of you."
"No, I have come to speak to you of a very serious matter."
"A serious matter?" said the Count, looking at Franz with the earnestness usual to him. "And what may it be? Are we alone?"
"Yes," replied the Count, going to the door and returning. Franz gave him Albert's letter.
"Read that," he said.
The Count read it.
"Ah."
"Ah," said he. "Did you see the postscript?"
"I did indeed. What think you of it?" inquired Franz.
"Have you the money?" he demands.
"Yes, all but 800 piastres.
The Count went to his secretaire, opened it, and pulling out a drawer filled with gold, said to Franz, "I hope you will not offend me by applying to anyone but myself."
"You see, on the contrary, I come to you first and instantly," replied Franz,
"and I thank you. Have what you will." And he made a sign to Franz to take what he pleased.
"Is it absolutely necessary, then, to send the money to Luigi Vampa?" asked the young man, looking fixedly in his turn at the Count.
Judge yourself, replied he. The postscript is explicit. I think that if you would take the trouble of reflecting, you could find a way of simplifying the negotiation, said France.
How so? Returned the Count with surprise. If we were to go together to Luigi Vampa, I am sure he would not refuse you Albert's freedom. What influence can I possibly have over a bandit? Have you not just rendered him one of those services that are never forgotten?
What is that?
Have you not saved Peppino's life?
Ah, said the Count. Who told you that?
No matter. I know it. The Count knit his brows and remained silent an instant.
And if I went to seek Vampa, would you accompany me? If my society would not be disagreeable?
Be it so. Where is the man who brought the letter?
In the street. He awaits the answer.
Yes, I must learn where we are going. I will summon him hither. It is useless. He would not come up.
To your apartments, perhaps. But he will not make any difficulty in entering mine.
The Count went to the window of the apartment that looked onto the street and whistled in a peculiar manner. The man in the mantle quitted the wall and advanced into the center of the street.
Salite, said the Count, in the same tone in which he would have given an order to his servant.
The messenger obeyed without the least hesitation, but rather with alacrity, and mounting the steps of the passage at a bound, entered the hotel. 5 seconds afterwards, he was at the door of the cabinet.
Ah, it is you, Peppino, said the Count.
But Peppino, instead of answering, threw himself on his knees, seized the Count's hand, and covered it with kisses.
Ah, said the Count, you have then not forgotten that I saved your life.
That is strange, for it is a week ago.
No, Excellency, and I never shall forget it, returned Peppino, with an accent of profound gratitude.
Never? That is a long time. But it is something that you believe so. Rise and answer.
Peppino glanced anxiously at France.
Oh, you may speak before His Excellency, said he. He is one of my friends.
You allow me to give you this title, continued the Count in French. It is necessary to excite this man's confidence.
You can speak before me, said France. I am a friend of the Count's.
Good, returned Peppino. I am ready to answer any questions Your Excellency may address to me.
How did the Viscount Albert fall into Luigi's hands?
Excellency, the Frenchman's carriage passed several times the one in which was Teresa.
The chief's mistress?
Yes. The Frenchman threw her a bouquet. Teresa returned it, all this with the consent of the chief who was in the carriage.
What? Cried Franz. Was Luigi Vampa in the carriage with the Roman peasants?
It was he who drove, disguised as the coachman, replied Peppino.
Well, said the Count. Well, then the Frenchman took off his mask. Teresa, with the chief's consent, did the same. The Frenchman asked for a rendezvous. Teresa gave him one, only instead of Teresa, it was Beppo who was on the steps of the church of San Giacomo.
What? Exclaimed Franz.
The peasant girl who snatched his moccoletta from him was a lad of 15, replied Peppino. But it was no disgrace to your friend to have been deceived. Beppo has taken in plenty of others.
And Beppo led him outside the walls, said the Count.
Exactly so. A carriage was waiting at the end of Via Macello. Beppo got in, inviting the Frenchman to follow him, and he did not wait to be asked twice. Beppo told him he was going to take him to a villa a league from Rome. The Frenchman assured him he would follow him to the end of the world. The coachman went up the Via di Ripetta and the Porta San Paola, and when they were 200 yards outside, as the Frenchman became somewhat too forward, Beppo put a brace of pistols to his head. The coachman pulled up and did the same. At the same time, 4 of the band, who were concealed on the banks of the Almo, surrounded the carriage. The Frenchman made some resistance and nearly strangled Beppo, but he could not resist 5 armed men and was forced to yield. They made him get out, walk along the banks of the river, and then brought him to Teresa and Luigi, who were waiting for him in the catacombs of San Sebastian.
Well, said the Count, turning towards France, it seems to me that this is a very likely story. What do you say to it?
Why, that I should think it very amusing, replied France, if it had happened to anyone but poor Albert.
And in truth, if you had not found me here, said the Count, it might have proved a gallant adventure, which would have cost your friend dear. But now be assured his alarm will be the only serious consequence. And shall we go and find him? Inquired France. Oh, decidedly, sir. He is in a very picturesque place. Do you know the catacombs of Saint Sebastian? I was never in them, but I have often resolved to visit them. Well, here is an opportunity made to your hand, and it would be difficult to contrive a better. Have you a carriage? No. The Count rang, and a footman appeared. Order out the carriage, he said, and remove the pistols which are in the holsters. You need not awaken the coachman. Ali will drive. In a very short time, the noise of wheels was heard, and the carriage stopped at the door. The Count took out his watch. 12:30, he said. We might start at 5 o'clock and be in time.